This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
When we learned in 2015 that Cambridge Analytica had bought data from an app developer on Facebook that people had shared it with, we did take action. We took down the app, and we demanded that both the app developer and Cambridge Analytica delete and stop using any data that they had. They told us that they did this. In retrospect, it was clearly a mistake to believe them. And yes, we should have followed up and done a full audit then. And that is not a mistake that we will make.
It's been many years since the Facebook and Cambridge Analytica privacy scandal captured headlines and brought company founder Mark Zuckerberg to the U.S. Congress to admit error. The services at the heart of the case no longer exist, but the legal case in Canada continues to march on. Last month, the Federal Court of Appeal overturned a lower court decision that had largely sided with Facebook. In its place, it released a new decision that includes an analysis of reasonableness under Canadian privacy law and engages with the notion of a potential trust but verify standard when data is transferred to third parties. The case may not be over yet, but the latest decision has big implications for privacy in Canada. Here to explain is David Fraser, one of Canada's leading privacy practitioners, a partner with the law firm MacInnis Cooper and creator of a popular YouTube channel on privacy law. He provides the background on the case, assesses the key findings, and considers what may come next. David, welcome back to the podcast.
Happy to be here, Michael. Thank you.
Glad that you've come back on. You know, I think for many, the Facebook Cambridge Analytica privacy scandal will seem really like ancient history. It's events that took place over a decade ago, and the public response to the revelations that came out of that case also dates back many years. But there is a Canadian case that just keeps going. It's sort of the Energizer bunny, seems like sometimes, with privacy. About a year and a half ago, my colleague Teresa Scazza appeared on the podcast to talk about a federal court ruling in the case. But just last month, the Federal Court of Appeal overturned that decision. So there's quite a lot to unpack. I thought you did a great job on your really exceptional YouTube privacy channel. For people that haven't seen it, I'll put a link to it in the description for this podcast, and you should check it out because it's fantastic. And so thank you for coming on to revisit the case here. Why don't we start with a bit of the factual background? People may be familiar generally with Cambridge Analytica and Facebook, but if we could go back a little bit, what took place, and even more, what are some of the processes that we've seen from a Canadian perspective?
Sure. Yeah, it certainly does seem like a blast from the past, and it does relate to circumstances that existed quite a long time ago. And if you think back, if you're a longtime Facebook user, you'd think that, you know, 10 years ago, Facebook was a very different product. In fact, in 2007, they launched what they called the platform, which was a platform on which app developers could launch apps that would then interact with users. And I recall getting invitations and updates related to friends on Facebook playing Farmville and other things like that. But there's quite a large range of apps developed by third parties, so not Facebook, that Facebook led on the platform to interact with the users, to provide entertainment and other things for the users. And around November in 2013, there's a Cambridge University professor named Professor Kogan who launched an app on the platform. It was a personality quiz. It's called This Is Your Digital Life. And the app collected personal information about the user and the user's friends. So it's kind of a psychological personality sort of survey to try to, I guess, presumably the value to the end user was it would give you information about your own personality, and that'd be interesting. And so clearly the app would collect information about the user who chose to launch the app or install the app, launch the app and answer the surveys. But it also in the back end, like many other apps, it collected some basic information about that user's friends on Facebook. And then subsequently it came to light that Kogan, Professor Kogan, sold the data that he got from this app to a company called Cambridge Analytica, which then used it for kind of wide-scale psychographic modeling purposes. And so that was for a period of time of about 2 years. And Cambridge Analytica then came to really worldwide attention in connection with the 2016 US election, where it was alleged that this data was used for manipulative micro-targeting of advertising. And so that hit all the headlines, prompted a number of investigations by privacy regulators around the world, most notably the Information Commissioner in the UK at the time.
We see the UK getting involved, other privacy commissioners getting involved. Why don't we pick up the story of how it makes its way to Canada? What took place from a Canadian perspective in terms of privacy regulators, and then how does it make its way into the courts?
Well, all of it got probably the similar amount of attention in Canada as it was getting around the world, which prompted our Federal Privacy Commissioner of Canada and the Information Privacy Commissioner of British Columbia to launch a joint investigation into Facebook. Now, I find it notable that nobody in Canada has investigated Cambridge Analytica or made any attempt to do so, but they did this joint investigation into Facebook and issued a joint report of findings in around 2019. And both of them found that Facebook, or they concluded that Facebook violated federal and British Columbia privacy laws and used it as a platform to call for more significant privacy law reform. And they pointed to inadequate consent, particularly from the friends of friends, who might not have been aware of the app being used by their friend and basic, what was often called public information being shared with the app at that time. They expressed concern about what they found to be improper lack of oversight of their privacy practices for these apps on the platform, and had concerns or expressed concerns about overall lack of responsibility for personal information on the platform. Now, at the time that the report of findings was issued, Facebook disagreed with these findings and also disagreed pretty strongly with the recommendations, saying, among other things, that there wasn't any confirmation or evidence that anybody could put forward that any Canadians actually used this particular app or that their information was subsequently misused by Kogan in connection with it. And they also expressed concern that the remedies asked for by the commissioner went well beyond the authorities set out in PIPEDA. And also, I think this is a pretty reasonable thing as well, they pointed out that in the intervening years, so much had changed in terms of the platform, which actually no longer existed, and Facebook's privacy policies, that the OPC was actually addressing a situation that really no longer exists. So largely it was moot, which kind of forced the hand of the privacy commissioner in a sense, or I would imagine they felt their hand was forced. So the privacy commissioner commenced an application in the federal court in February 2020 in order to seek an order against Facebook that aligned pretty closely with what they were looking for in the first place. And also in return, Facebook filed an application for judicial review of the OPC's findings and actions on that particular file.
Okay, interesting. So we get a finding largely consistent, I suppose, with what we start to see from a number of other privacy commissioners or data protection commissioners. We end up in the courts, both sides effectively going to the court. So what did the federal court rule once it had these actions commenced by both sides wanting to re-examine this issue?
Yeah, so the federal court heard the matter in March of 2023, and they issued their decision, or the court issued its decision in the next month. And it's important to bear in mind, and for listeners to understand, that an application made by the Federal Privacy Commissioner at this stage, it's called a de novo hearing. And so it's not an appeal of the commissioner's findings. It's not an application by the commissioner to enforce a particular order. So it kind of goes back to square one. And so the privacy commissioner would have the burden of proving that Facebook, for example, did not get adequate consent, or Facebook did not adequately safeguard personal information, or that their privacy practices were inadequate. And Facebook would have the opportunity to respond with that. So, but the commissioner would have to bring forward essentially all the evidence that they had compiled in connection with their investigation. And what was really surprising at the end of it was a real kind of smackdown of the privacy commissioner, essentially saying that there was a whole lot of hand waving, a whole lot of requests of the court to make inferences from the evidence that they brought, but not enough actual evidence. And the court faulted the privacy commissioner, for example, for not actually using some of their investigative power. So the commissioner doesn't have much remedial power at the end of an investigation, but in connection with an investigation can compel evidence, compel the production of records, can compel testimony. And so the court essentially said, you know, the privacy commissioner fell short on meeting its threshold in order to set out any of the things that they were looking for, and ultimately no justification for the sweeping order that they were looking for. So not surprisingly, the privacy commissioner appealed that.
Yeah, no, that wasn't a surprise. And as I mentioned off the top, people are looking for a deeper dive into that particular decision can listen to the podcast episode with Teresa Scazza. But now we get to the Federal Court of Appeal, which overrules that decision on several grounds, and I wanted to walk through some of those. Now, the role of reasonableness is critical here. Can you explain, I think, broadly speaking, the role that reasonableness plays within Canadian privacy law, and then how the court addresses the question of how to determine it, as it does play a pretty big role here as part of its analysis?
Sure. Yeah, certainly. If you were to look in any Canadian private sector privacy law, you're going to find the word reasonableness or reasonable comes up all the time. It's something that is just there in privacy laws. But the Federal Court of Appeal did some interesting things with that. So it turned on whether there was adequate consent from users and users' friends. And the trial court said, you know, there wasn't enough evidence. It was being asked to draw inferences on two very different positions that were put before it. And the court below said it would have been very helpful to have expert evidence on what Facebook could have done differently, or subjective evidence about what Facebook users would have expected at that time. So looking for something subjective with respect to the audience of users at Facebook. And the Court of Appeal actually said none of that really matters. What matters is an objective standard that's based on the perspective of the reasonable person. And what that means is that the court determines what is the reasonable person and what the reasonable person thinks. And this does not require direct evidence from the population of users or even for expert testimony. So that allowed the Court of Appeal to say, we understand what is reasonable. Reasonableness is the threshold. Reasonableness wasn't reached here, and therefore there wasn't adequate consent. And the Court of Appeal even said, it was the responsibility of the court to define an objective, reasonable expectation of meaningful consent. To decline to do so in the absence of subjective and expert evidence was an error.
What are your thoughts on how they went ahead and went through some of that reasonableness analysis? It would seem to have some pretty significant implications for privacy law going forward, particularly as you mentioned, you crack open the statute and you find this term appearing all over the place.
Yeah, lawyers know that reasonable is an objective standard, and reasonable standards exist all throughout, not just privacy laws, but other places like that. And in the privacy context, it comes up very often when it comes to Section 8 of our charter related to kind of unreasonable search and seizure, and talks about subjective expectation and objective expectation. But this seems to move it entirely over to objective. And I think privacy law and privacy as a field is pretty nuanced. And so I think just implying or imposing a reasonable standard, an objective standard, is a bit of a blunt instrument. And so within the Facebook decision, a lot of the decision turned on the question of what's called valid consent. And that's defined in section 6.1 of PIPEDA. Now it does set a reasonable standard, but with reference to the particular individual from whom consent is being sought. And so it says the consent of an individual, so an individual, is only valid if it's reasonable to expect that an individual to whom the organization's activities are directed would understand the nature, purposes, and consequences. And so, but it really talks about the individual. Is it reasonable to expect that the individual understood? So we really should be thinking about, at least my interpretation of the statute always has been, we really need to think about what did the individual understand at the time. So is what the company did reasonable, but with reference to that individual? And PIPEDA also says, you know, organizations have to make reasonable efforts, so the use of the word reasonable again, to ensure that the individual is advised of the purposes for which the information will be used. And to make it meaningful, the purposes must be stated in such a manner that the individual can reasonably understand how the information will be used or disclosed. And the reasonable expectations of the person are relevant, not the reasonable expectation of a reasonable person, but the reasonable expectation of the person. And at least to me, in the past, I think this is what the statute still says, the law clearly directs you to look at the person and not just some objective standard that kind of hangs over everybody. And to make it a little bit more meaningful, so we have findings from the Privacy Commissioner, and we've had guidance, and this is one of the Privacy Commissioner's strategic objectives related to kids' privacy, which call on us, as we advise, at least lawyers in private practice, who advise organizations that might collect user disclosed information related to young people, is to understand where the young people are coming from, what their expectations are, what their comprehension level is, for example, in terms of understanding what's going on. And the Privacy Commissioner has even said, you know, people under the age of 13 aren't capable. And so that really does tell you that you have to look at the person who you're dealing with. How you manage that information might be judged by an objective standard, but you're still looking at a person. And then at the end of it, at least for me, privacy is inherently connected to dignity and autonomy. So I get to make choices about my own personal information, assuming that, or hopefully that I'm sufficiently apprised of what's going on. And I'm not a fan of the notion of the privacy commissioner or a judge making those decisions for me, because privacy is so connected to individual choice and dignity.
So does that suggest your company, you've got a wide range of different users, you're collecting large numbers of different data points about those users, you want to know your user base quite well, and technically you know them at an individual level, even though we may be talking about millions or hundreds of millions or billions of those users, that you've got to put yourself in each individual's shoes to a certain extent based on what you know about them to try to provide the kinds of disclosures or the sort of information that you can say that the consent generally in the circumstances of that kind of person, given that the kind of indications that they've got, is reasonable. And that may differ a little bit amongst your user base.
I do think that's the case. And while I hesitate to throw another reasonable in there, it's kind of, is it reasonable to expect that a young person in this particular audience, if that's what the audience is made of, would reasonably understand? You're kind of drawing lines or trying to come up with aggregate characteristics of the particular audience, but you still need to be taking that into account. So for example, on the Facebook case, if let's say all of their users, if there was evidence that all of their users were using apps on the platform and all of those users would have been repeatedly exposed to privacy notices that would have told them that information related to their friends are going to be shared so that they would know that their information, that would increase the knowledge level of that and would alter the expectation of that audience. And so I don't know whether that's the case, but it would help calibrate understanding, well, what's reasonable in the circumstances of what's going on, and what's going on relates to a particular audience of users.
Speaking of those friends or the others that kind of are in that circle in terms of information that's being used, there's another element in this case where there are questions about the consent being applied, not just to the specific individual who is the Facebook user, but to their friends, their broader network. The court didn't have much trouble at all saying that lower court got this wrong. Can you talk a bit about what that issue is all about?
Yeah, and I'm not surprised that it was a whole lot easier to deal with, because simply it's almost a connect the dot exercise in a sense. So the legislation says the knowledge and consent of the individual are required for the collection, use, and disclosure of personal information. So somebody installs an app, and they share their own information, you know, they would have knowledge and hopefully would have given consent. But if information related to their friends ends up being collected by that app, that friend doesn't know that it's taking place. And so you certainly fail on the knowledge part, and then you probably also fail on the consent part when it comes to that sort of activity. Whether or not, I suppose one could make an argument, but I didn't see it kind of emphasized a whole lot. Say, look, that we got a rep and warranty from the friend that they had the permission of their other friends in order to share that information, but that seems kind of weak. And so in that sort of circumstance, it's pretty easy to connect those dots and determine, you know, those friends of friends didn't know about the sharing of their information with the app. And so if they didn't know about it, then the knowledge and consent part certainly isn't there. And so at the end of the day, I think it was pretty easy for the Court of Appeal to make that determination on the evidence. But also, I think it's probably worth noting that it's 2024 right now, and so this is all moot. It's my understanding that this simply doesn't happen anymore on the platform. Facebook has moved on from the platform entirely and from this sort of model of information sharing.
Okay. I mean, that highlights, of course, some of the challenges, generally speaking, of regulating in this space where you're focused on a particular business model or a particular kind of activity, and things move so quickly that by the time, and we're not even potentially done here, but by the time you start really looking at it, things may have moved on, and some of it, as you suggest, may be moot, although of course the standards themselves continue to be relevant in certain respects. You mentioned the rep and warranty and the lack of it, in a sense, that might have applied in third parties, or third parties not being able to provide that information. You might have it from the direct user. There's one other element in this case that's, I think, important. You describe it as essentially requiring a trust but verify standard in the video that you did on this particular case, and it has to do with the platforms that grant third-party access to user data. And you mentioned business models may be changing, but can you talk a bit about the court's how the court walks through that analysis in terms of a platform that has certain agreements may have reason to believe that some of those sites may not live up to everything that they've agreed to? What sort of obligations does the court seek to impose on the platforms themselves?
Yeah, so with the former Facebook platform, anybody who wanted to launch an app on the platform had to agree to particular terms of use with Facebook, so a contract with Facebook. Part of that contract was they had to implement specific standards and requirements and needed to have a privacy policy and a privacy statement. And Facebook argued, and I think this was reasonable to argue, that if you choose, so not the friends of friends, but if you choose to share your information with a third party, like Dr. Kogan, that third party becomes responsible for what happens to the data after that point that's in their hands. And we know now that Dr. Kogan's actions violated the terms of the contract that he had with Facebook. And you know, Cambridge Analytica in the big picture here is really the bad guy. And the position that the Privacy Commissioner put forward was that, you know, Facebook retained responsibility for the data even when it was in Dr. Kogan's hands. And so Facebook had residual responsibility for the mischief that took place a couple steps away from their handling of the information or the transfer to Dr. Kogan. And most privacy practitioners will say there's a difference between a disclosure of personal information and a transfer of personal information. So transfer is more if you have a service provider. So if my law firm hires somebody to store records for us, we remain responsible even if the record storage company does something mischievous with it, and we have to have a contract in place in order to do that. But if information is disclosed, the recipient is the one who becomes responsible for it. And Facebook argued it was disclosed to Kogan, and Kogan remains responsible for it. And you know, the Federal Court of Appeal agreed with that largely, but took issue with the transfer part and whether there was enough diligence going on at the time. And part of Facebook's argument in the Court of Appeal and the court below was that they had a contract with Dr. Kogan, and that said he had to handle the personal information in a particular way. Now, he violated that contract. And there is law in Canada that strongly says you can rely on the good faith performance of contracts. So Facebook said we relied on that in order to fulfill what would be our obligations with respect to safeguarding the information. If you have a bad actor who runs off with it, that's going to be on them. And the Court of Appeal said, yes, you can rely on the good faith performance of contracts, but really not where there are red flags or signs that the company will not fulfill their obligations. And the court found that there were flags, red flags, and you know, there were some admissions from Facebook after the fact saying, yes, there are things that we could have done better, and statements that we were not in a position to guarantee that there weren't bad actors on our platform. And the court said, look, if you can't have confidence that there are no bad actors on your platform, that means you can't necessarily rely in good faith on everybody not being a bad actor. And so ultimately, the standard is, you know, if you have any reason to believe that the company will not fulfill its contract, at least in the privacy context, in good faith and properly, well, then you assume greater responsibility of making sure that either you shut off the tap of personal information, you don't allow information to be disclosed to them or otherwise. And so this is, it's an interesting finding because, you know, there are certainly many contracts in place, data processing agreements and things like that, that companies do rely on in good faith. And I know most companies will do a significant amount of due diligence about anybody who they're partnering with. But I wonder how far this can be taken. So it's no longer relevant to Facebook of today because the platform doesn't exist. But I wonder, for example, whether Canadian regulators will try to extend this logic to app stores. For example, the app store operated by Apple is kind of like, not identical to, but kind of like the Facebook platform where developers develop apps that are made available through that app store that will then ultimately collect user disclose user information, just as in not in a negative sort of way, but in just inherent in the use of the app. And will this put on a company like Apple additional legal responsibility to monitor down the pipeline how apps that appear in the app store collect user or disclose personal information? And so, you know, you get a decision from a court of appeal and the principles that are expressed are going to be implemented and are going to be used in reference to a whole bunch of other circumstances. And I do hesitate to suggest that it would be a good thing to put that amount of responsibility on somebody who has probably less control than Facebook might have had 10 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, that does sound like it's awfully close to the application of the accountability principle that we see directly in the law, where, as you note, companies very often will transfer that data and they'll have contracts in place. And if the supposition of the court is that, well, if there are some red flags there, then it essentially is on you. Yeah. Does that have the potential to be a bit of a game changer as part of reliance on the accountability principle, doing some due diligence and contracting it up? But if as part of that, there's some evidence to suggest, well, there may be some issues along the way, suddenly now you're taking on a heightened level of potential liability if you've either failed to continue to follow up or simply walk away because you say, I can't rely on that principle in the way that I might have hoped to.
Yeah, it certainly muddies things. And I think it creates a gray zone between a disclosure of personal information to a third party, where that third party has to have consent to collect it in the first place, but once it's disclosed to them, they take all the responsibility for it, and the disclosure's obligations kind of end. So you end up with a line. And when for transfers for processing under the accountability principle, yeah, the transferor remains 100% legally responsible for it and has to make sure that all those sorts of contracts are in place. But this seems to perhaps put in a due diligence obligation with respect to anybody who's involved in the consent process for a disclosure. And so it becomes the onus becomes on them in order to make sure that that consent is adequate, but also is that consent accurate? So if the company says, oh, yes, we're looking to collect this information for our own purposes, for these three purposes, but maybe there's a fourth that they're looking to do, that could be problematic. And, you know, we're moving into an era of open banking. And so what are the implications for that as well, where we're going to see more and more third-party service providers looking for access to information related to our financial lives in order to provide services to us? But it's the creation of an ecosystem where, you know, people are quite concerned about liability. And this is a potential new one that might not have been on their radars in the same way a couple of years ago.
Okay. Fascinating to see some of the really potential broader implications for Canadian privacy, far beyond a platform that, at least within Facebook's context, doesn't even exist anymore. I guess, why don't we close with this? What next for this case? It's been a long time, but it's not necessarily over yet. What are some of the possibilities that you see going forward for this particular case?
Yeah, this case, I would say, is far from over. And the reason why I say that is, so when the decision came out, the Court of Appeal, so the Federal Privacy Commissioner wanted a significant order, multi-part order against Facebook related to future practices. And the Court of Appeal said, you know, they weren't ready to do that. They needed more evidence and things like that. So the Court of Appeal gave the parties 90 days to agree to the terms of an order, failing which they'd have an opportunity to make submissions on the appropriate remedy. And so that 90 days doesn't expire until, I think, the second week of December of this year. And I wouldn't expect an agreement. There was such vehement disagreement between the Privacy Commissioner and Facebook. So I wouldn't expect that they could find a middle ground. And so I would expect there will likely be another hearing, after which the Federal Court of Appeal would issue an order. And it would be that order from which Facebook might seek leave to have an appeal heard by the Supreme Court of Canada. And so that may be, so this particular case in the Court of Appeal is not yet over. And then there may be a subsequent appeal. And I think that there's some interesting legal questions about the proper interpretation of PIPEDA and the imposition of an objective standard across the board, which would be an interesting question of law for the court to consider, particularly when you look at PIPEDA being characterized as quasi-constitutional legislation. And unless the Supreme Court of Canada steps in, the Federal Court of Appeal does have the final say on interpreting that particular statute.
Okay, super interesting. A case involving a platform that doesn't exist anymore with a potential appeal, depending on what happens in the House of Commons, about a statute that may not exist anymore, at least in terms of what governs privacy. But nevertheless, it's the Cambridge Analytica case itself had huge implications for people's perception of privacy and some of the risks associated with platforms. And it sounds like this case could likewise have really significant implications for how Canadian privacy law gets interpreted. David, thanks so much for coming on the podcast to break down the case and some of its bigger implications for privacy in Canada.
Happy to, Michael. Thank you.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbites@pobox.com. That's LAWBYTES at pobox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter at lawbitespod or Michael Geist at mgeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca or subscribe via RSS at Apple Podcast, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo LeBron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose LeBron LeBoy. Credit information for the clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes for this episode at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening and see you next time.